It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell, filling in today for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferretz. Today on the show, we're talking with the candidates competing in next week's primary election in Wisconsin's 7th Congressional District. Before the news, we heard from Republican Don Rahela, who's running against incumbent Sean Duffy in the primary. Now we turn to the two Democrats on the ballot, beginning with Kelly Westland. She's a small business owner in northern Wisconsin and serves on the Ashland City Council. She's one of the Democratic candidates in this race for Wisconsin's 7th Congressional District. Her primary opponent is Mike Gracine. Kelly Westland joins us from our studios in Superior. Welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start off with why you decided to run for Congress.
Well, I have a background that has largely been focused on building coalitions to solve problems. And when I considered the person currently representing me in the 7th Congressional District, I honestly believe that I'm capable of making better decisions and being a better representative of the people in my community. So I felt compelled to challenge him.
Now, you're a relative newcomer to Wisconsin's political scene. Does that help or hinder you?
I think it's a little bit of both. One, obviously, I've got to work on name recognition, make sure that voters know a little bit about my background. But I'm not really that much of a newcomer. I have served on city council since 2011, but I've also been engaged with the party for a number of years and have been involved as an activist for a decade or more.
And what else in your background would set you up for Congress?
Well, I have a degree in conflict resolution, so I think some skills there that could be put to very good use in Congress, for starters. But I grew up in a military family, have lived in communities across the country and gotten to know people from all walks of life. And professionally, my work has focused on helping communities become more self-reliant, whether that's through renewable energy or local food systems or economic development. There are a lot of lessons learned that I think could be applied across the board at the federal level.
What do you see as some of the biggest challenges facing your district in northern Wisconsin?
Oh, wow. That's a good question. We've been having roundtable discussions throughout the district on a number of focuses. Lately, it's been veterans issues, but also my background working with family farmers and trying to understand the needs and concerns of folks like that in this district. We have a broad rural area. You know, this district is twice the size of New Hampshire. And oftentimes we don't have the kinds of resources that we need to really build up infrastructure that would promote economic development. I would love to see more investment in not just education, but also in our infrastructure that will help make our communities more competitive, whether that's, you know, fixing our roads and bridges or expanding access to broadband internet. All of these things are the core of what can help, you know, build the populations in our communities and make sure that we all have the chance to be successful.
Are there any particular investments in terms of agriculture apart from the infrastructure in that large rural district that you'd like to see?
Oh, absolutely. Right now, we've got these really wonderful growing sectors of sort of the more localized version. There was a study done a few years back that showed that the communities in northern Wisconsin and northern Minnesota were exporting billions of dollars a year to import food. And at the same time, we have the capacity to produce a lot of that right here. And that means, one, keeping those dollars local, but two, creating products that we can then export to bring money back in. My work with the Bayfield Regional Food Producers Cooperative over the last few years is a great example of some of the things that we can do when we get people to work together and build up the infrastructure that they rely on, whether it's for actually, you know, working on the farm or aggregating their products, packaging their products and distributing them to customers, and also some of the skills that come as far as customer service and logistics, that sort of thing. There is so much opportunity to really step up the capacity for agriculture to do good things for northern Wisconsin. And I think that's a great place to start.
Well, another sector of the economy has gotten a lot more attention there, and that is mining. The iron mine has been a big subject for debate in that area and in the state as a whole. Would you support the proposed iron mine project in northern Wisconsin?
I am opposed to that project for a number of reasons. One, if the goal is to create jobs, this mine is a job killer. All of the economic opportunity that shows any real momentum in northern Wisconsin right now is focused on things like agriculture, forestry, tourism, outdoor recreation, fisheries. And all of those things are put at risk if we allow this particular company to move forward under this regulatory framework that we have, the new mining law. It's just taking other opportunities off the table. And I think the local opposition is so strong that I don't really see that project moving forward.
But won't it in itself bring a lot of jobs and probably better paying the jobs than in sectors like tourism?
That may be the case, but one, we know that we can look at empirical examples of other communities that have relied on this sort of mining operation. It's a boom and bust economic cycle, for one thing. It's a finite resource, and when that resource is gone, we have to have diversity in our economy so that we can make sure that our communities are stable moving forward. The other thing is that this company cannot be trusted. We've heard them tell us that they're going to be good paying jobs, that they're going to be union jobs, that they're going to go to the locals. But the fact is, they've also talked about this being one of the most state-of-the-art mines. And if you look at state-of-the-art mines, much of the work is actually automated. They don't employ as many people as they used to. And chances are pretty good that these are highly technical jobs, that they'll bring in workers from other states that already have those skills. There's no guarantee that they'll be unionized either.
You've in the past made a point of saying that one of your first priorities would be an increase in the minimum wage, I think, to $10 an hour. Make the case for that.
Sure. I think $10 is a great starting point, 10-10. But I think the best way to illustrate it is to look at, you know, the classic example, Walmart. There was a study that came out recently that said that 52% of Walmart employees rely on public assistance of some form. To me, that says that those people aren't being paid enough, and therefore they're relying on taxpayers to help them make ends meet, to help keep them out of poverty. And that means that while Walmart is just colossally profitable, they are making those profits on the backs of taxpayers. Taxpayers are subsidizing their cost of doing business because they're not paying their employees enough. If we raise the minimum wage so that people working full-time are above poverty level, then that means that they won't have to rely on those other programs, and we can save those taxpayer dollars.
Now, the reality is, even if elected, you'll probably be in the minority party in the House, the way things look now, in a divided Congress. How do you reach across the aisle to work on the minimum wage or any issue for that matter? How would you help overcome gridlock to get something done?
Sure. Well, I think that anytime you have to get past something like that, it starts with one person taking the initiative to extend the olive branch, but to also get folks who are also frustrated with the gridlock to sit down in the same room together. And instead of, you know, fighting with one another from your own position, you sit on the same side of the table and look at the problem ahead of you. And you work together to say, we have this shared challenge. How do we solve it? You know, what are the mutual benefits that we can identify to make sure that everybody gets, you know, their basic needs met and we can solve this problem as a whole? We have so much in common that, you know, it's frustrating that Congress is fighting over the few things where we're so divided. And instead of, you know, working together to move this country forward, we're left with the least productive Congress in the history of our country when we're facing real problems. I think that people are ready to see a change.
You have a primary to get through first. How do you distinguish yourself from your opponent on the Democratic side of the ballot, Mike Crisine?
Well, I have been a member of the party, though I'm certainly one to point out when I think that there's room for improvement. I believe that if I want a party and a country that I can be proud of, then it's up to me to engage, to take my seat at that table and be a part of guiding the discussion in a way that makes sense. And I know that Mr. Crisine joined the Democratic Party this past May, just before he announced that he was running on the Democratic ticket. But as far as our substantial policy positions, we're very, very different. I think that he and I can agree that you know, the big banks on Wall Street that are bigger now post-reform than they were before, that they need to be held accountable for the harm that they did to our economy. But at the same time, I believe in a woman's right to make her own choices as far as her family planning and healthcare decisions are concerned. I guess I don't really know much else about where he stands, but I know that in the past when he's run for office, he's run as an independent libertarian or Republican, something closer to that end of the spectrum.
Turning to an issue that got left on the table last week as the congressional session ended, immigration and the tens of thousands of Central American youth detained at the border. What would you like to have seen come out of Congress and go to the president?
It's such a troubling situation. We have these children who are coming here as seeking help, and they're coming from a very dangerous place. It's the murder capital of the world in Honduras right now, and they're fleeing from, you know, a terrible situation. And for Republicans to say, well, we should just send them back, you're literally saying, let's send children back into harm's way. That's not the America that I know. I think that we need to take a step back and consider our values and really put ourselves in the shoes of the people that are there. These children are coming because their parents really believe that they are better off far from home in a place where they might have the potential opportunity. And again, it's one of these things where we're smart people. We are capable, creative, innovative people. I'm sure that we can come up with a better solution than what was put through Congress or largely more likely left waiting for a solution. We have families across this country that would be willing to welcome these children with open arms and give them a safe place to be until we can do something else to resolve the situation in Central America that will hopefully address the problems that we're having.
Very briefly, a final message to voters.
Well, you know, this is a government for and by the people, or at least it's supposed to be. And corporate campaign contributions will keep drowning citizen voices until we each show up and take our seat at the table. Your vote is your voice and your power. Make sure that you use it on Tuesday, August 12th.
Kelly, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
That's Kelly Westland. She's the Democratic candidate in the 7th Congressional District primary election. She joined us in our studios in Superior. Today, we're talking with the candidates on the ballot in next week's primary election for the 7th Congressional District in northern Wisconsin. Moments ago, we heard from Democratic candidate Kelly Westland. Now we turn to her opponent in that race, Mike Crisine. He's a design engineer, a farmer, and a Democratic candidate in this 7th Congressional District primary. He joins us now by phone. Mike Crisine, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me, Rob.
Well, starting with the basics, why are you running for Congress?
Well, I'm running for Congress because I think government is going in a very wrong direction. I think the federal government is very big and out of control, and I've heard a lot of agreement in the public out there on that. It's a huge framework that big banks, big corporations are using to initiate and promote and instill regulations that squash small farms, small businesses, and the civil liberties of the average citizen to dust. And we need to change that.
Can you tell us a little bit more about your background and how it might set you up to work in Congress?
Sure. Well, my name is Mike Crisine. My website is weaponofmassreduction.org. And I'm an engineer. I've been an engineer, aerospace engineer, for the last 22 years. I've done program management. I've worked on missile systems, guidance and navigation of missile systems. I've worked on aircraft turbine engine aircraft systems, sensor systems for those aircraft. And I've also done some of my own program management during those programs. I've also run a mechanic shop. What we did is truck modifications. I took that business from roughly a $250,000 a year venture to a $2.5 million a year venture, hiring mechanics, managing and developing the facilities from almost nothing to somewhere where we could really generate some revenue. So I know a little bit about business. I know a lot about engineering. I know a lot about human nature, and I know a lot about the Constitution of the United States and why it was formed, why it was developed back in those days. The founding fathers knew that the people in power needed to be controlled and power needed to be limited. That's why they wrote the Constitution that limits government, limits the size of the federal government, and also specifically and strictly itemizes what the federal government can do. And right now, the federal government is going way outside the limits of what it can do, and it's promoting a field, like I said, of the big guys with big money coming in and using it to regulate us to death. And also, it's just way out of control, and it breeds corruption.
Now, you've run for office as an independent in the past, I think. In talking about your political beliefs on your website, you refer to yourself as a JFK Democrat. Can you talk more about that and how that shapes your views on today's issues?
Absolutely. JFK was was a very popular president because he was fighting for everybody's civil liberties, and specifically civil liberties, racial and also from the government. He was wise enough to know that the Federal Reserve was a bad thing, and he was starting to fight against that. He believed in small, effective government, contrary to my political opponent in the primary here. She is for expanding government and benefits, and that's really all she has on her website. But JFK, back in '63, the Revenue Act of 1963, the federal budget was $100 billion with a B. Today, it's $3.45 trillion with a T. It's growing exponentially. But back in JFK's day, he knew that a small, effective government was best. That's why on that $100 billion budget, he proposed a $13 billion cut. That's a 13% cut to the size of the federal government in just 1 year. He ran on the campaign that let's get America moving again, and that's exactly what he wanted to do. He cut the budget, and he also cut corporate income tax rates, and he cut personal income tax rates by about 13%. Not 13% in the rate of growth, 13% from the actual expenditure being made. And what did that do? Well, it turned the economy around. Prior to that, the economy was grinding at about 1.5 annual growth rate. By the time JFK's changes got through, he didn't live to see it, but Johnson got it through. By the time his changes took effect, the growth rate was 6.6% on average from 61 through 69.
Let's turn
that was huge. That was a huge improvement.
I want to turn toward your district there. I'm sorry, we don't have a ton of time, so I want to get to a few other issues. What do you see as some of the biggest challenges facing your district in northern Wisconsin?
Well, I think one of the biggest things that we face is, like I'm running on, is a huge federal government that's out of control. Everybody is being crushed by the size of the federal government and adding more taxes and more expenditures and more entitlements is not going to help the situation. We need somebody that's going to fight for our civil rights against the federal government, both political and economic, and that's what I intend to do. I intend to show everybody how they've been lied and manipulated by the big guys, the big power brokers in D.C., and that includes our current congressman, Congressman Duffy, who's currently accepting just from Sally or from Goldman Sachs alone $18,000. So if he's getting $18,000 from Goldman Sachs, who is he representing, our district people or Goldman Sachs? So this is one of the big things that we need to fight against, is we need to fight against these big people using the federal government. But the biggest thing to take away from it is if this federal government wasn't the size that it is now, they would have very little to do within the government. They wouldn't have the power to manipulate people through the federal government and instill regulations. So we need to shrink the size of the federal government. We need to get rid of entire departments that aren't functionally doing what they were supposed to do, what they were set up to do in the first place, like the Department of Energy, the Drug Enforcement Agency that's lost the war on drugs. Part of this immigration problem that we've been seeing is to hide and mask drugs coming across the border. Before this big, huge immigration issue started a couple months ago, the drug cartels were getting roughly 50% of their drugs across the border. Now, as they flood the border with people, they're getting 90% of their drugs across the border. So, you know, one thing in this federal government where issues are hidden within issues or hidden within issues is that we've got a big drug problem and we've got a big immigration problem. And holding out amnesty as a card and trying to lure and bait these people across the border with that is absolutely ridiculous. People are dying in the desert. We need to shoot down amnesty and make sure that immigrants coming to the U.S. are legal, and those that are not legal get deported, and the countries get billed for the deportation cost.
I wanted to get into the iron mine issue in your district. It's been a controversy in the state. The federal government will have some say on whether that happens. What is your view on the proposed iron mine?
I think America needs steel, and Iron County needs jobs. I think taconite mining is one of the cleanest environmentally of all the different types of mines. I'm an engineer. If there's problems, environmental issues that people have concerns about, we can sure address those technically through engineering endeavors, which provide jobs in and of themselves. So just to create the mines out there would create 2,000 jobs in construction alone, getting ready to start the mines. You know, and it's a small area. People like to be scared by the 4 mile length of it. But the mining company has bought the property. The mining company has agreed to take care of the environment. It's a clean operation. The area out there is filled with mines from the past already, and there's not a whole lot of three-headed walleyes and three-headed kids running around out there either. So we need to get jobs moving again. One of the things that a lot of the social socialist Democrats love to point out is Walker didn't create jobs. Where are the jobs, Walker? Well, you know what? When you're shooting down jobs up north, when they got 14% unemployment in Iron County alone, when you shoot down those jobs, you're talking out at both sides of your mouth. We need the jobs in Wisconsin, specifically up there. Mines would be terrific jobs. Those people need mines. They want to stay up there. But a lot of the social Democrats, they don't want people staying out there. They want very limited people out there. They want to move everybody into the city. And we need jobs out there.
Mike, very briefly, just a few moments left, a last message to voters.
I'm running as a JFK Democrat, and I think one of the worst things you could do is vote for more socialism. We're already drowning in a federal government that's hugely pregnant with socialism. We need to get rid of the socialism. That means not voting for progressive Democrats. That's number one. Number two is not voting for the same old thing. Mr. Duffy has been bought and paid for by the banking interest and the big corporation interest, and he toes the party line with the obligatory entitlements that he's created for homeless up in the area.
Mike, so, that's all the time we have. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks a lot.
That's Mike Crisine. He's running against Kelly Westland in next week's primary election, the Democrat side of the ticket in Wisconsin's 7th Congressional District. Around the country, particularly difficult missing person cases often go cold. While news media lose interest and local police departments focus their resources on other active criminal cases, a growing group of people are taking to the web to try to solve these overlooked mysteries.
This team of amateur web sleuths attempts to match missing persons with unidentified remains. And according to our next guest, the drive to solve these cases gets so strong it becomes a competitive sport, complete with jealousy and sore losers. Deborah Halber joins us now. She is a journalist and author of the new book, The Skeleton Crew, How Amateur Sleuths Are Solving America's Coldest Cases. Deborah, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Gene. Thanks for having me.
Oh, you bet. I want to start out talking about the two groups of people, I guess the two main groups of people that you focus on in your book. And the one main group of people are the number of dead who have disappeared, who have died by under mysterious circumstances, and nobody knows who they are. There are more of them than you think.
Yeah, there really are. It's bizarrely common to actually come across a body with no ID. And, you know, if anybody's ever watched any of the cold case TV shows, you know that as long as there's no information, the case goes cold really, really quickly.
And then the second group of people that you focus on in the book are, I guess, amateur web detectives who have taken off over some of these cases on their own time, on their own dime, on their own computers, you know, sort of off the police radar, and have attempted to solve them. And it appears also that there are more of those people than you think.
Yeah, in the early days of the internet, this actually started becoming a bit of a trend. There were people who would go around and look for traditional sources of information, newspaper archives, microfiche, death notices, and they'd start putting that information online. And the big advantage to that was the information they had up there was crossing state lines. So suddenly people around the country realized that they could look at missing person reports, they could look at these databases, and start trying to put two and two together.
Now, you focus on a lot of stories and a lot of people in your book, but one of them who sort of runs the whole arc of the book is a guy named Todd Matthews from Tennessee, and he is one of these web detectives, and he is involved in any number of cases. Talk a little bit about him and how he sort of fits the profile of somebody who's interested in taking on this work and what he derives from it.
Well, he does fit the profile because he basically got obsessed with a single case, and that often happens. All the stories that I tell in the book all start the same way, with a body being found. And then the mystery is, who is this person? And the case he happened to get obsessed with is a young woman who turned up dead in Kentucky in 1968, and she just became known as Tent Girl because they couldn't identify her. And Todd spent a decade of his life. He was only 17 and in high school when he heard about the case, and he just stuck with it off and on until the internet actually came along, and that's what helped him reunite her with her name.
And ultimately, he was successful. Ultimately, he's done other work of this kind, too. But what is it about these web detectives? And you used the word he's obsessed with this case before. What is it that drives them to investigate these cold, cold cases of people that they've never met, you know, of a death that has sort of passed into legend?
Yeah, that's something I really wrestled with in the book. I really wanted to understand that. And I think the answer is that what happens is that people stumble upon a case, and it is initially curiosity. It's a challenge. You know, who doesn't love a mystery? But I think as time goes on, I think they become kind of personally invested in an individual case. And each city has their own almost little celebrity cases. You may not everybody may know about them, but they are out there. And as time goes on, they start wondering, you know, about the person individually, about their family. They think they have to have family out there. They have to have friends out there. And I think it turns into a compassionate cause. But there are a lot of people trying to do the same cases at the same time, and that's when it gets competitive.
Yeah, competitive. Like, and so within this world of web detectives, you call one group kind of the Mavericks, and the other one's the trust builders. And that is an example of a rift, but I imagine it devolves even more than that.
Yeah, that is definitely one of the ways in which some people feel like they want to be working behind the scenes, they want to be helping law enforcement, they don't want any personal recognition. And others are more like they want to be the ones who are calling law enforcement directly, they want to be saying to them, hey, I've got this match, I want you to look into this. And it's a pretty big philosophical shift and is split, and it does cause a lot of adversity, and you know, a lot of these people are using screen names on these sites, so they're saying things that they might not say if they were actually seeing the person face to face.
Yeah, I was interested to read in your book about that there are networks, you know, that the web detectives sort of operate within a framework of sorts, and that they are connected in a sense, and they are often kind of do know what others are doing and what cases are out there and what's being found and so forth.
Exactly. There are a few major organizations. Some of them, there's the Doe Network, as in Jane and John Doe. There's WebSleuths.com. There's the Charlie Project. There's Can You Identify Me? There are groups that have really developed over the years, and they each have their particular followers.
And so what do the police think of all this, you know? I mean, on the one hand, they're taking cracks at cases that have long since been, you know, gone cold. On the other hand, they have a lot of things on their plate right now, and having somebody email them or call them up with a clue about this 30-year-old case has to be kind of a pain sometimes.
Exactly. Some of the police have dubbed these groups or individuals within the groups the Doe Nuts, as in Jane and John Doe, and they think of them as a colossal waste of time, and they really don't like getting calls from them. But on the other hand, I actually have talked to detectives who have become very dependent on some of these groups, and there's at least a few detectives who feel like they could not have solved some cases without this help.
So when you started writing the book, did you have sort of a thesis in mind as to the kind of people you were going to meet and the kind of work they'd be involved in and whether they were doing good work? And did that perspective change over the course of your writing?
Well, to some extent, I assumed it had to be an altruistic kind of endeavor, and to a large extent it is. But I had no idea the kind of people I would meet. They're all over the country. They're all ages, all walks of life. A lot of them have, they're kind of underemployed. They're, you know, they're very, very smart, but their day jobs are not very intellectually challenging. Some of them work in, you know, in big box, you know, hardware stores, supermarkets. And then this hobby is really a challenge, and they take it on a lot of hours, almost every night. Weekends, they're on the web doing this searching.
Now, as you look ahead, do you, and you've had a chance to take a pretty good look at this, what do you think there's a lasting impact that these, you know, amateurs are going to have on the way that law enforcement handles missing person cases in the future?
I do. I think what has to happen, which hopefully will happen, is that the police, law enforcement, will see the people out there as a resource, and they will one day be working side to side, maybe just having them in the police station inputting data or going out to get a DNA sample from a family. But these people are willing to do this, and they have the time and the interest, and law enforcement, frankly, doesn't always have the resources.
All right. Well, Deborah Halber, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We've been talking with Deborah Halber. She is the author of The Skeleton Crew, How Amateur Sleuths Are Solving America's Coldest Cases.
It's time for Teach Me What You Know. This week, smack dab in the middle of vacation season, we'll learn how to overcome a fear of flying.
This summer, there have already been some high-profile airline disasters causing even more anxiety for people who are already nervous about flying. So we've brought in a former airline pilot turned therapist to help deal with the fear of flying. He is Captain Tom Bunn, president of SOAR, a company that helps clients overcome their fear of flying, and the author of SOAR, The Breakthrough Treatment for Fear of Flying. Tom Bunn, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much for having me on.
So it's 2014. Tell me how common this idea of fear of flight is these days.
Well, about one person in three has trouble with it. And of that one in three, half don't fly and half white-knuckle it. If you look at the record we've had in the last 10 years in the U.S., no major U.S. airline has had a fatal accident. But the statistics don't seem to change how people feel about it, because in order to feel safe, we need to be in control, or we need to be able to escape a situation that goes bad immediately. And that isn't possible on an airplane.
And the fear of flying, it's not necessarily a rational calculation of the risks or anything like that. What is behind the fear people feel when they're flying? Is it that lack of control you mentioned?
Well, yes, because there is an interesting mechanism in the brain that, first of all, there's a thing we call the amygdala. It sounds like a funny word, but it's just a Greek word meaning almond. There's an almond-shaped and almond-sized little cluster of brain cells that is highly interconnected, sits right behind the eye. And its job is to act sort of like a smoke alarm in your house. It sits there and monitors what's going on all the time. And as long as everything is routine, you don't hear from it. Been there, done that, that's boring. So it kind of memorizes what you do day in and day out, and that lets it ignore anything that's routine. But if something happens that's not routine, or even you imagine it vividly, the amygdala is going to fire off stress hormones. Okay. When it does, it grabs your attention, just like the smoke alarm does with noise. So if it grabs your attention, then what do? First, you want to take a look and see what's going on. If you can be sure that what's going on is a false alarm, there's no problem, you drop it, and that's the end of the stress hormones. But if you're not sure, then the next step you go to is, all right, what do I need to do about this situation? And the way the brain is wired up is if you can come up with something to do, and the thing I think is amusing is it doesn't matter whether the plan you come up with is a good one or a lousy one, whether you commit to it, that's the key thing. If you commit to a lousy plan or a good plan, it's going to stop the release of stress hormones, at least until you find out it's a lousy plan. Then it might start all over again. But when you drive your car and a car comes at you, you get a shot of stress hormones, you decide what to do. You hit the brake, turn the wheel, whatever, and that stops the stress hormones, so people feel very comfortable in their cars. And then the second thing is if you can't come up with a plan, then you want to be able to get out of there. Mm. And in the airplane, you can't. So here's where you're stuck. First of all, when you hear a noise or feel the motion of the plane, you're going to get the stress hormones. You can't be sure that you're absolutely safe. So you go to the control. Ah, wait a minute. I don't control the situation. I need to get out of here. Oh, I can't do that either. So you can see it's not a good recipe for emotional control if you have to control emotions consciously. Now, there are people who, because they feel so secure in general, they regulate stress hormone release unconsciously. They don't understand why anybody has a problem with flying. But a person who has to regulate it consciously doesn't understand why everybody doesn't have a problem with flying.
So how do you take, because the way you lay it out, it just sounds so logical and so sort of matter of fact, but anybody who's been on a crazy bumpy flight in a thunderstorm with a landing that just terrifies you knows that life just isn't always that linear. So how do you take the things you've just talked about, you know, so nice and neat and tidy, and put them onto that plane in that thunderstorm?
Well, you first got to be sure that what you're doing actually is okay. You got to be sure that it's not a foolhardy thing to do. Statistics don't seem to help people, but if you can think about how control is valuable to us, if an anxious flyer can understand how flying is so controlled, that does give them some help. And so I go about it by giving people a pilot's point of view of how flying works. If this particular problem develops, this is the first step the pilots choose to do to remedy it. If that doesn't work, they go to the next. And then if that doesn't work, they go to a very simple solution to turn on some systems that are very basic to deal with the problem. So when you realize we've got that kind of thing set up for everything that could go wrong, then people feel pretty comfortable about flying, at least intellectually. So, once again, that doesn't change how they feel emotionally. Emotionally, as you can see, it's a different ballgame. It's got to be, I've got to be in control or able to escape to feel comfortable. Once the stress hormones are released, so what we do is we say, okay, now that you're satisfied that flying is okay, what can we do to just turn off the release of stress hormones? It's like in your kitchen with a smoke alarm. If the toast is burning toast, you could, if you wanted to do so, take the battery out to get rid of the noise. Well, we can do that with the amygdala. There is a hormone called oxytocin that, when it's produced, it turns the amygdala off. So we look for a situation that produces oxytocin. We say, okay, go back and remember that vividly. I'll give you an example. When a mother is nursing a child, she produces oxytocin, large amounts, so that she feels mellow and doesn't feel anxious like, oh, somebody's going to come over, they're going to say I'm a lousy housekeeper. No, she doesn't care. She just takes care of what the baby needs. She can do that because oxytocin is calming her by shutting down the amygdala. So we look for a moment that produces oxytocin, then we just, like Pavlov's dogs, we want to link that event that produces oxytocin to the door of the plane closing, the plane taking off, cruising along, even if it's in turbulence, landing, and so on. And that takes care of the stress hormone release.
So we picture a situation where we feel comfortable or someone who comforts us and consciously focus on that on each step of the plane flight, and that might trigger oxytocin and calm down that amygdala?
Well, there actually, you've kind of covered two systems there. There is a system that if we're with someone that we're very calm with, that system works not hormonally but neurologically to slow the heart rate and activate what's called the parasympathetic nervous system. That's the gut-level calming. So the other is a moment that produces oxytocin that prevents the release of stress hormones. Mm-hmm. Now, what I tell people to do is don't wait till you get on the airplane and try to do this. The amygdala reacts very fast. We want to do this in preparation. We want to do this before the flight. Go through the things that are going to happen on the flight. You know what they are. The door closes, the plane taxis out, and so on. You want to imagine that you have some photographs and use black and white so that it's not too likely to trigger stress hormones. Black and white snapshot. And put it by the face of the person who's very attuned to you, person you feel both physically and psychologically safe with in that moment. So that links it up to the what you suggested, the calming person that you're with. But a mother who's nursing a child can, or who has done that, they can link to a moment where they recall nursing the child and pretend that they're holding, or someone's holding a picture by the baby's face. So that then links the baby nursing to oxytocin, and the other is the system where you link the friend's face to the slowing of the heart, right?
Is there a difference if you're traveling alone or if you're traveling with somebody, you know, a spouse or a family member? Do any of your methods change, or is it pretty much the same thing regardless?
Well, what I want to do is have people build in what they need, because if you are with someone, it does help you feel better, but depending on somebody with you tends to be a day late and a dollar short. When you're still going to get the stress hormones. You're going to feel better because you're with someone. What you can do, though, if you set this exercise up before you fly and link it up so it works automatically, you can nip it in the bud. You can prevent the release of stress hormones or instantly override it. You don't even have any feeling that you're stressed at all.
Also, for pre-flight anxiety, I understand you have a trick you call the 5-4-3-2-1. What is that?
Yes. Well, it's just a game to play with yourself to keep your mind occupied, to keep from letting the anxious thoughts take hold. Once you do have an anxious thought, it produces the stress hormones, and then that keeps you focused on the anxiety-producing situation. So you play this game with yourself. What it amounts to is, first of all, focus on something straight ahead that tends to keep the mind focused. So find some object to focus on. Like I have my computer here. Okay, so I'm going to look at the Apple logo. And in my peripheral vision, I can see some other things. I'm going to make five statements. Five statements starting with the words, I see. So there's a little hypnotic kind of repetitious thing there. So I see a copier. I see a photograph. I see a screwdriver. I see my cell phone. I see my glasses. Okay, five things I see. Okay, now we've got to switch to things I hear. Well, I hear the sound of my own voice, so it's very quiet here. I can hear a car outside. I can hear the refrigerator. Oh, no more new additional things I'll go back to. I hear the sound of my own voice, and I hear the car outside. Okay, so it's okay to repeat things, whatever's coming to mind. Then, so we've gone from what you see to what you hear. Now we go to what you feel. I feel the phone at my ear. I feel my elbow on the chair. I feel my foot on the floor. I feel the label of the shirt on my back. And I feel some kind of itchiness back there also. It must be an insect bite. I don't know. Anyway, five things you see, five things you hear, five things you physically touch. Not the things you feel like I'm upset, but physical, basic things that you physically perceive. Okay, if you kept doing this for about 2 minutes, with intense concentration, the stress hormones will be used up, and then you'll be relaxed again. But to make sure that you keep the exercise challenging, you don't keep doing five. The second time around, seeing, hearing, touch, you do four. Then the next time you do three, then two, and then one. This exercise was actually developed as an insomnia cure. Because if you do this when you're trying to fall asleep, you basically push the anxiety-producing thoughts to keep you from going to sleep aside. But it works also for flying.
We'll leave it there for now. Tom, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
That was Captain Tom Bunn, president of SOAR, a company that helps clients overcome their fear of flying, author of SOAR, The Breakthrough Treatment for Fear of Flying.